local produce donor to Harvesters, the community food network. But first, the environmental news for the week of 10/14. In California, multiple fires are raging across the state. These fires have occurred as the public utilities Southern California Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric have implemented blackouts across the state to prevent wildfires, leaving hundreds of thousands of people without power. Investigators found the poorly maintained transmission line sparked the campfire last November. Climate scientists say hotter and drier conditions across California due to rising greenhouse gas emissions have made wildfires more widespread and more intense. This is the same in Bolivia, South America, where heavy rains over the Amazon have brought raging fires under control after nearly 10 million acres of land burned over the last 2 months. In New York City, over 60 protesters were arrested last week after shutting down an intersection in the heart of Times Square. More than 700 activists from Sydney to New York City have been arrested in coordinated climate protests across the globe as activists with Extinction Rebellion shut down streets and occupied public landmarks to demand action on the climate crisis. A study by the University of New Mexico found that hundreds of Navajo women presented alarming levels of uranium in their systems, even decades after mining of the radioactive metal ended on the reservation. A group of babies also showed uranium levels far higher than the national average. 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg met with indigenous youth climate leaders last week as she visited the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. KCUR reports Fort Leonard Wood is home to more than 6,000 soldiers and at least 3 endangered species. They're protected and cared for, despite living among shelling and other military training, and scientists flock to the installation, saying it's a boon to their research and gives them the opportunity to help the animals. EPA reports they've honored 3 local top performers in the freight industry with their annual SmartWay Excellent Awards. Woody Bogler Trucking Company, Bold Transportation Incorporated, Shilly Corporation, Trans Am Trucking. Congratulations all. Now, our show.
Good evening. Good evening. This is Richard Mavian, and I am glad to be here. I see, like, this is a good fall day. I usually have something to say about the weather before I get started with my show, and this would be the perfect day to do it. This is one of those days when you're not for sure what you should put on when you get ready to go outside your house. The one thing about it, you can always put on enough clothes to stay warm. Just sometimes you put on too many clothes and you end up be burning up instead of feeling as comfortable as you would like. Glad to be here. It's been quite a month. I just want everybody to know that I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere. For some reason, I ended up having appointments and having trips and getting invited to various conferences around the country. It's been quite an experience, and I've had a chance to see the environmental progress that's being made in this nation, from Baltimore on the East Coast to L.A. on the West Coast to stops in between. I was in Albuquerque. I was in El Paso, but that was kind of a thought-provoking stop because of the shootings that have gone on there recently, and you can't help but feel that while you're in town, not that there's anything going on to cause you to feel it, just in your own mind, you emotionally feel that. So, and then I had some experiences coming back. When we went to the lower half going through, so that's when I went through El Paso all the way into L.A., but coming back, I came the top route to go through Phoenix and that way. And traveling through New Mexico and Phoenix is really kind of strange, especially New Mexico and Arizona, the desert part. And you know, and I was in New Mexico, and I started wondering, what is New Mexico's gross national product? You know, you're riding down a highway, you don't see cows, you don't see nothing. You know, when you're in other states, I mean, you see windmills, you see cows, you see
hatch peppers,
horses. You don't see nothing.
Peppers, that's what I'm
saying. And so one of the persons I was with, I had her to look it up on Google, and it came back, and it was uranium. uranium. I mean, you know, you wouldn't have thought about that, but after you hear it, you start realizing that, yeah, that could definitely be a factor, and that's why you don't see a whole lot of other stuff out there, like cows and that kind of stuff. So it was a good trip. I really enjoyed it. Got, like I said, I got to see a lot, and I'm sure in time all of you will hear bits and pieces of the things I experienced. But tonight, I have an experience that I received when I was with the group that was in Baltimore. And this young lady I have on the phone was there. And I got a chance to meet her. And the first thing I thought about was, what a lovely person this would be for all of you to hear. So I'm not going to get engaged in it because I'll sit up and I'll be then told the story. I mean, that's just how lovely is she. I'd have no problem if she wasn't here talking about it myself for a whole hour. So I'm going to let her come on the air. I'm going to introduce her. Her name is Halder.
Halder.
Blamoville. I could spend an hour talking to you about your name. I just want you to know that. That is a very, very unusual name. And I'm sure there's got to be some kind of little story behind it. But first of all, I want you to tell people who you are, where you are, and what it is that you do.
Well, I am a physician, practicing pediatrician. And like you have traveled around the world practicing medicine, as you know, I'm originally from the Bronx, but went to school here in the United States, but also went to London University where I did public health. That led me on over to Africa, where I spent quite a few years practicing medicine, and as you probably know, being from the Bronx and practicing medicine in the areas up in the hills in Ethiopia and Kenya and whatnot, that medicine is not like it is in this country. There's one major hospital in the capital of these countries, and I had my clinic in what you would call the boondocks.
Okay, now I want you to save that.
And how I got my patients.
I want you to save that story. We're going to come back to your African trip, okay?
Okay.
I'm going to start you out on your current missions because I want to make sure we get that covered too. So tell us about what it is you're doing. You're in St. Louis, right?
I'm in St. Louis.
Okay.
And
talk to
right
us
now. I am doing several things. One of the most important things that I'm doing is working with the community and with organizations like the Sierra Club and the two universities over things like climate control and water. We have statistics that show the minority population children, in particular, they have more asthma because of the air quality where they live, lack of air conditioning, and also dealing with the same problem that has been dealt with in other areas of the country, like Flint and Newark, where they have water has been infiltrated with lead through the pipes.
Okay.
And here in St. Louis, as in Flint, some of it is now going on. They found water contaminated with lead in the schools.
That is
70 schools.
That is. How did they do that? I mean, tell me about that process.
They went and they took samples of the water in the various schools. Was mandated that they go ahead and do that. And what they found out that in the schools that the water, the lead in the water was higher than it should actually be. And in many places it was not the lead pipes, but when the put the pipes together, the the thing that putting the pipes together that was leaking into the water. And what we found here in St. Louis, one of the things that they were doing is to go ahead and on a Monday morning run the water from about 6 o'clock on, and then go ahead and say that it was okay, there was less lead after it ran for a while. Now, that was done perhaps to cut costs, et cetera, but I know that within the last month, in Newark, what they did was to go ahead and bypass that. And in the schools in Newark, New Jersey, what they have done is the children are no longer allowed to drink the water in the schools. Hopefully, in places like St. Louis, Missouri, and other places where they find that there is lead in the water, that somehow or other, if they're not going to be able to make the corrections in the pipes, then they probably need to do the same thing.
Okay. Now, here we go. I have a tremendous amount of concern about the lead being found in the pipes coming from the water that we drink. Let's start with Flint, and I had a lot of concern about that. And my comment to folks were that, you know, even though I know that the powers to be should be held accountable for that circumstance of allowing those pipes to get to that point that we had our children and people in the low-income communities drinking water that was lead contaminated, I always felt like that there was something that parents and stuff should be doing to keep their children from drinking that water. I make a big issue out of that. I just want you to understand, because I'm one of those individual responsibility persons that saying that it gets to a point that we as a human race have to really take some responsibility ourselves to make sure we're not allowing our children to do that. Now, that's just on my point in particular. But I want to come back to this thing in St. Louis. If I heard you correctly, with that being an issue, you're saying that the solution that the powers to be have come up with is to come into the schools early, 6 o'clock in the morning, and just turn the water on and let it run so it can flush out the pipes to the point that the level of lead found in the water is within what would be considered safe government guidelines. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
That's what has been done.
What? My God. You know, when you sit and you think about it, you would think, especially after what happened in Flint, that an all-out effort would be going for to replace those pipes. That's just basically a token way of handling what I consider to be a very dangerous circumstance. Then you take me to Newark, and you're telling me up there they just telling the kids not to drink the water.
And they give them bottled water, yes.
And they're not doing anything with it. The water's still over there. I mean, that person that wasn't thinking, you know, you're absent-minded someday, you're not thinking, you just, it just doesn't seem fair that in this country that we live in, and I'm not a big person that goes all out protesting and complaining about what's going on in the country. I realize that doesn't benefit the people that we serve. Especially when you serve the low-income community, your responsibility is to find ways for them to be able to survive regardless of the circumstances they have in the face. But I it's very difficult for me to sit here and hear you saying that they basically doing nothing.
Well, it's not just St. Louis. You know, if they finally decided to do it in Newark, I am sure that there are places all over the United States where the water has more lead in the schools than it should have, and that either they are not running tests because they don't, they are not going to do anything about it. Now, most of the time, and I know this for sure, there are 70 schools that tested high levels of lead in the St. Louis area. Evidently, in Newark, I don't have the figures of how many schools tested positive for lead. I just know that it was enough to pass the resolution that there would be no drinking of the water in any of the schools in Newark, New Jersey. And I'm sure that there are other places where that should be the same ruling, that the water should not be consumed. Now, I know that your audience knows that the reason that I am concerned is because of the effects of lead.
Yes.
It has a whole lot to do with the behavior of the kids, and a whole lot of our kids are being treated for ADHD, this, that, and whatnot. So their behavior, abnormal behavior, and then the other thing that happens is the learning problems for the children. It affects the learning ability of these the children.
Wow. Now, you have a business? Are you working in a department for some government agency? What is it that you actually do?
Well, at one point, and this is how I initially started off, first in New York, and then I moved to St. Louis, and I became the medical director of the lead program, lead evaluation program here in the St. Louis area. And so what I was to do was to try to put a handle on the lead problem here in the St. Louis area, working with the city and working with the CDC, et cetera, and set some sort of guidelines and standards for the lead. Now, I know that it used to be in many of the housing. It was not just in the water pipes at the schools. It was in the housing, the lead paint, and the laws were passed that there were not supposed to be lead-based paints where children, in homes where children were supposed to be. There's supposed to be groups. The city had federal grants to check the homes. And I guess what happens is they were, at that point, they were wondering about the homes, yeah, and we're not doing too much with the schools. And now, with all that is actually going on, you know that I think I mentioned to you way back in the 80s, did a test or got a grant, and what I was able to do was to go into the jails. And went into the jails, and there's a radiolucent line on the long bones of that is caused by, it's called the lead line. And it gets there as the bone, as a person is growing from childhood on, if they ingest the heavy metal lead, what happens is this line gets larger and brighter. And in the jails, I found out by doing these x-rays and looking at the lead line that a good 70% of the people that was in the jail at that time had the lead lines, which means they were ingesting lead from when they were growing, when they were children. And the conclusion that I came to was that this probably, in some cases, had something to do with why they were where they were, their, yes, behavior, yes, that got them into the penal system.
You know, we did an interview once with here on the air with a guy that wrote an article. He was from, I think, Harvard, if I'm not mistaken, about, mm-hmm, how pollution had a negative effect as far as like the creation of violence and that kind of thing. They,
right,
they had proof that they, it caused a rise in that type of behavior. Now, here you are, we're talking about lead, which is capable of producing the same effect. You know, you mentioned and you talked a little bit about Holmes, but when you were talking about the schools, the first question I had for you was going to be, well, if it's in the school, does that mean it could be in the houses too, the homes too?
Well, it could be inside of the homes. When you're moving into a new situation, they're supposed to check for lead. That whether or not it's done in all cases,
right,
is something that I can't control. But that is supposed to be, especially if children will be living there.
Okay, now, so if it's the reason that it's affecting these 70 schools, is it because of the age of the pipes? Is that the reason?
Not so much the age of the pipes. What they found out that in many cases it wasn't coming from the pipes, but when you put the pipes together,
okay,
when you cement the pipes together and join the pipes, that material was leaking into the pipes. And that is what was causing the lead to get to the children. That's here in St. Louis. Now, in other places, it might be the age, but that was the major reason that they found here in the St. Louis area.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get to, if in fact it is the substance that is used to connect the pipes together that has been considered the source of the leak, then shouldn't someone be held accountable?
Someone should be held accountable, but if you go ahead and you heard about Flint, they knew that there was contaminated water for quite a time, and nothing was done about it until much later. And so, there's accountability. We all should be accountable for it because we know it's there. But we also know that in many of the inner city schools and whatnot, there are not the resources or the willingness to go ahead and do much more than what is actually being done. I know that here it would cost an awful lot to replace the pipes and the sediments and the schools. There were 70 schools. That would be a tremendous amount of money, and I doubt very much that the government, the city, the feds, or anybody is willing to go ahead and take on that expense. And I again refer you to what was done in Newark, where it was more of a convenience to go ahead and supply the bottled water than it was to go ahead and eliminate the problem.
You know, I've had a lot of shows on this air, on this station, on this program, 10 years worth, and I cannot ever remember feeling as disgusted as I do right now because of that problem. I mean, you know, I was able to accept the diesel problem, the diesel emission problems coming from your trains and your trucks, because it's a circumstance of life that we're not going to get away from, and we started dealing with people on ways that they could behave to help control the air that they breathe during the times of days when it could be at what would be considered a peak. And so I even had got myself to that position. But this is different because you're talking about something. Everybody has a right for clean water. If there's a human right, and you're telling me about circumstances where our future generation, our babies, where our babies are in a situation that the water that comes from the places where they're attending school is lead contaminated. And the only solution is to flush the pipes every day before the kids get to school.
flush the pipes. Where does that water go? Where does that flush water go?
I guess it goes to the sewer, and wherever that goes, whatever place, that's it.
So they're contaminating the water. They could say it was a river. A lot of times that water comes out of sewers and goes into rivers and stuff. So they're contaminating the river. You got fish in the river. I mean, this is, you know, it's just, like I said, very disappointing, because you want to think that we as a human race would be more conscientious about what we're doing to our children. And then, and again, I know people, you're out there listening, and I sound like a broken record, but it's just affected me in that manner. But you to tell me that Flint, that they just figured that they got their problem solved by telling people to drink bottled water, and are doing nothing to remediate that problem. That's unreal.
And as I said, I do not think that one particular place is guilty of that. I'm thinking that wherever they picked it up, there probably many places there, if they're not using the bottled water, people have told me in some schools, I imagine that somebody has found out that more lead is in some faucets, so some of the faucets are actually closed off. They're not. Nothing is done, but they close off the faucet. And my feeling is, if there's one contamination at one faucet, what makes me think that it turning off one makes it better to drink out of another one.
Yeah.
So there are places where they haven't used the bottled water, but they've decided to use certain faucets and block off others.
Boy, I tell you, it's amazing. I guess it shows a need for people like you and others in this world that are doing the things they're doing to exist. If we didn't have you, we wouldn't have this story, you know? We would not have this story if we didn't have you. This is something I think bears attention. When I think of the political persons that we have for the state of Missouri, I would think that that would be something that should be receiving some direct attention. I would also question what's going on in the homes. I have been a person, an advocate of the need for infrastructure change, for renewing our infrastructure as a means for creating sustainable employment for that 25 to 54-year-old folks out there that are in need of some type of a decent, good-paying employment, because we have so much that needs to be renewed. We need pipes all over the country. I mean, when Trump first went in office, he talked about this infrastructure problem and how that was going to be a potential avenue for employment opportunities. And in listening to you and talking about the circumstances going on in the school, those pipes need to be changed. I'm sorry. They just need to be changed. I mean, we need to be able to figure out some way. You would think. I know there's nothing I can do about it but sit here and talk to you about it and raise my voice and act crazy. But common sense says that that is something that needs to be given become a front burner issue. When I think in terms of the debates that's going on in this country, in Congress, over what I consider to be menial stuff, here we have kids that are being put in situations where idle-mindedness can lead them into some deadly circumstances. That's the same. That's sad to see. I tell you what, Helder, I'm going to take a break here. We'll be right back with you. You're listening to KKFI 99, 90.1 FM.
This retired federal employee, Bill Claus, encouraging all my federal employee friends to please consider supporting KKFI during this year's combined federal campaign. That's CFC code 21994. Just a few dollars a week on payroll deductions won't mean much to you, but it'll mean big bucks to us at KKFI. So please consider supporting KKFI. That's agency code 21994.
This is Macy Lane with KC Jazz Alive. KC Jazz Alive is proud to be a community marketing partner of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Our mission is to enhance jazz in Kansas City for musicians, patrons, venues, and educators. We work to raise the tide that lifts all jazz boats and are honored to support all the great jazz and other diverse programming on KKFI.
You too can support KKFI. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In sub-Saharan Africa, hundreds of millions of people live without electricity. Women often cook over indoor fires, and children study by the light of kerosene lamps. But burning wood and fuel pollutes homes and warms the climate. So one organization helps women in Nigeria and Tanzania bring clean and renewable energy to their communities.
They themselves are kind of the best ambassadors for clean energy.
Fid Thompson is with Solar Sister. The nonprofit helps women start businesses selling clean cook stoves, solar lamps, and other solar products. Solar Sister mentors the women and provides them with inventory. Thompson says the saleswomen use the products themselves and can personally describe the benefits.
They are really passionate about what clean energy can do for their communities.
For example, a clean cook stove.
It frees up time for women who are usually disproportionately burdened with the gathering wood or going to find charcoal.
It also saves the money spent buying fuel and improves family health by reducing indoor air pollution. So these women are helping protect the climate and their communities and making money in the process. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian again here at KKFI, and I'm talking to a beautiful young lady from St. Louis, Huldah Blamobile. And Huldah, I want to be able to turn the tide in this conversation we have, and I've been looking forward to talking to you ever since we had a program meeting about a month or so ago, and I saw I was going to be able to have you on today, and I refused to allow the drudgery of what we just been talking about to overshadow my pleasure of having you on this phone. I know you're not supposed to. I'll get into some things later, but now I want to start talking about that experience that you had in Africa. But before we go there, I want you to bring us up to date on this new position that you just got appointed to. Tell us about that.
Well, I have been a member since I was a medical student of the NMA, the National Medical Association, and you or your public may know that the National Medical Association was started because of the fact that many years ago, the AMA, the American Medical Association, did not let African Americans into the group in many states. And so the National Medical Association was started. I am a graduate of Meharry Medical School and basically have been with the NMA for almost 50 years now. And recently, I was asked at my advanced age to come on the board of directors of the National Medical Association, and I went ahead and said, well, okay, and basically, Richard, why I agreed to that is because of the fact that it gives me a national voice in terms of yes. being able to bring some of the problems that affects many of the minority people here in the United States bring it to the forefront. I am interested in, with the lead and the environment and effect on our children, but also I've done some research on sickle cell, and right now there are changes, and there's even a cure in the wind, but one of the things that is going on with this administration is that for many of the diseases or conditions for minority, some of the funding is taking away so that the research and cures have been slowed down. And so with the NMA, the National Medical Association, being the board of directors, I'm not going to say that I'm going to be able to change the tide, but at least make it aware of the fact that we are being held back from going through with many of the cures of disorders that affect the minority population.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, I have responsibilities. I do kind of a facilitating role as far as environmental literacy, and I do that with all age groups from us to the babies that are in school. And I have a assignment coming up here next month of going into two high schools and teaching the science classrooms about future employment possibilities. And so I really enjoy doing that. And I'm gonna add your line of work to that presentation, because I want people to understand that that's something that they can look into doing as they continue to advance in school and see its possibilities. And like you said, with the funding being cut, it's probably not a highly talked about subject in our schools like it should be. But I think it's good that our younger students get exposed to people like yourself to know that those kind of careers are possible. Which brings me to the most exciting part in this conversation. I'll go back, and I want the audience to be aware of the fact that when I first met you, the first thing you said to me is, I hope you don't mind talking to somebody that got arrested in the jail. And I went with not that that's not a common occurrence in the fields where we work, but I want you to bring us up to date on your experience. First of all, let's talk about this arrest that you had. Tell folks what happened.
Well, I am of the age and of the exposure that wants and feel that everyone should be treated fairly. And so I became part of the movement. And I was in Selma, and I got put in jail.
Okay.
Then that was the first time.
Are you a repeat offender?
Because I was once a protester.
Yeah.
And then for the second time, I was on my way to Africa. And in the airport, I was stopped. I had my passport, all my credentials and whatnot. But I was mistaken for Angela Davis. And so I was put in jail until a friend of mine who was an associate ambassador, I was able to get my phone call. And got me out of jail in Nairobi.
I mean, first of all, for those of you who are listening, if you don't know about Angela Davis, she was a light-skinned, as we would say in our race, black female who had a big afro.
And that's what I had.
And it's obvious to me that you had to be with a big afro, you couldn't say, no, that's not me. That you had to get somebody down there to
get me with my passport and my papers.
Yeah, that's quite a story. You are really an interesting person. I mean, that just didn't happen to a whole lot of folks, okay? And first of all, even though it was getting arrested in a foreign country that you had to go through, I think it would be an honor for someone to assume or see you as being someone as famous as Angela Davis. That's credit for you. Now tell us about your African experience. I want folks to hear that too.
Well, I think that one of the reasons I went into medicine was because the movement was going on. I initially went to college as a music major. I was supposed to be a singer.
I'll check you out.
Yeah, it is. But then the movement began, and I wanted to make sure, and this is, your listeners would not know too much about Marcus Garvey, but yes. Marcus Garvey was one of the first people that went ahead and said, we're going back to Africa.
Right.
I don't know. Do you know about him?
Oh, of course I know about him. I'm just,
well, my grandmother was a lieutenant in Marcus Garvey's
Go ahead, girl.
Army.
yeah, I got
so,
you.
So, you know, go and say that.
I knew I was dealing with royalty when I was talking to you.
So, anyway, changed and went into medicine because I had to be part of the getting our folks together and helping. I don't know if you knew that when the Europeans were in Africa on our continent, what had transpired was that they did not have any African trained actual MDs. What they did when independence was supposed to come was to take the have a school, and the school was in Belgium, and they would send you there, the native Africans there, to that school for a few months, and then they would have them come back to their own country, and at that time, they were called the doctors or whatever, but the only people they could practice on was on their own.
The natives.
They couldn't. Yeah. So anyway, make a long story short, went through the training and then did the tropical medicine at London University, then went to Africa and got myself a clinic in a place called Lulu, which was in the heart of the jungle.
What was that name again?
It was a place called the Lulaborg.
Lulaborg, okay.
Yeah, I had to, in fact, I had to learn, French very quickly along with the native language because hospitals and whatnot, when you went to the hospitals, you had to speak French because the French had been the ones, the Europeans, that were inside the country. So that was their language. But I make a long story short, I had to take care of the patients and get them down into the hospital in the city when they were really sick. And all the only way to do that was to get in a Jeep and drive through the jungles. And being from the Bronx, that was pretty scary. So I got an expatriate, a Belgian pilot, who had a little World War II plane and who had some illness. So I would treat him and get him medicine and treat him, but he had to teach me how to fly the plane.
So he taught you how to fly the plane.
To fly a little World War II plane to get my patients down to the city and to the hospital in the city. The only thing about that was at the little airfield where I was coming out of, there were no lights, which meant you had to leave at the crack of dawn, take the to get the patient there, set the patient up in the hospital, and then get back in the plane and fly in before it was dark.
Girl, you are a marvelous person. I mean, I am, ever since I heard you tell this story, I've just been like in a different world. As I'm sitting here listening to you talk right now, you know, I think about the various trials and tribulations that we as ancestors of former slaves still find ourselves facing on a day-to-day basis. You know, and I think about the people who are complaining about the things that they have to do. And I'm sitting here listening at you. And, I mean, it just sends chills through my body to know that at a time when there were no role models, you were there by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you were able to figure out ways to be able to benefit the people from which forth we come. God bless you, young lady. I just want you to understand that was one of the reasons that I wanted to have this interview with you. I wanted the world, because this will now be on our archives. It can be heard from anywhere in the world as far as that's concerned, to know that a person like you still exists in this world today. You're talking about being seen as Angela Davis, which means that we're talking 60s, 70s, we're talking mid-60 era, because mm-hmm. that's when she was doing her fight. You're not supposed to ask a lady her age, but I'm proud to know your age, and that's all I'm going to say. Because I think it shows how long and how dedicated and blessed your life has been. And I truly am honored to have had a chance to have you on as a guest of mine. I will always cherish this interview. I think that for someone, an old school person like myself, I am just inspired. I'm inspired to continue the fight, to continue the struggle,
Well, as you know, it's going to be a struggle to kind of get some of the changes with the lead and whatnot. I just wanted to throw in when we were in Baltimore, you know, when the people from the federal people came on in, I was not welcomed by them bringing up the fact that these with the water, what was going on in the schools and whatnot, they did not want to hear.
Yes, I remember that. Well, I'm going to have to cut our show. It's time for me to let you go.
Thank you for listening to me and having me on your show.
Oh, thank you for taking the time to be on this show. You will always be loved by Richard Mabian in Kansas City, and I'm sure many of the people who have heard you too. God bless you, and let's you and I always stay in touch, okay?
Okay, yes, Richard. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Here's the calendar of events for the week of 10/21/19. Tuesday, 10/22, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., there is a Sierra Club Kanza group meeting at Colonial Church in Prairie Village, Kansas. Shawnee Councilwoman Lindsay Constance and Roland Park Mayor Mike Kelly will speak about Climate Action KC and what leaders around the Kansas City Metro are doing to reverse global warming. Tuesday, 10/22, Women and Maintain Your Ride will teach women how to adjust shifting and brakes, change a flat tire, and clean and lubricate a drivetrain. Get tickets at Eventbrite for Bike Walk KC. 10/22, 7 p.m., the Sunrise Movement KU Student Organization Group will hold its first meeting in the Lead Center Conference Room. You do not have to be a student. See Facebook for more information. Wednesday, 10/23, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. will be the Clean Air Now monthly video conference meeting. Go to cankc.org for more information. Wednesday, 10:23, Help the Heartland Tree Alliance plant more trees in the Kansas City metro area from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., Delaware Ridge Neighborhood, Kansas City, Kansas, and Saturday, 10:26, 9 a.m. at noon, Newmark Brooking Neighborhood, Kansas City, Missouri. Contact Bridging the Gap at btg.org. Saturday, 10:26, 10 a.m., Drawdown, Getting into Action Workshop Series at the Temple Buddhist Center, Unity Temple, 707 West 47th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. You can go to Facebook to register. Saturday, 10:26, 10 a.m., there is a fall tour of Baldwin Woods, 500 East 1600 Road, Baldwin, Kansas. The tour will be led by Kansas Biological Survey scientists and is open to the public. Trails are primitive. Wear appropriate footwear and bring water. The tour will be canceled if weather is inclement. Contact biosurvey at ku.edu with questions. These items and more can be found on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. Please listen to Eco Radio KC next week. Stay tuned for Fiesta Musical.
Farmers put covers on their fields, but don't let them sleep on this current cast. You might think soil could use a rest between growing seasons, but leaving soil bare through winter makes it vulnerable to heavy rain and winds that cause erosion and wash nutrients out of the soil. Enter cover crops, which are grown between seasons to enrich soil and protect water.
When you have cover crops, they increase the infiltration rate of the water into the soil.
That's James Horman of Ohio State University Extension. He says cover crops prevent runoff that carries polluting nutrients, sediments, and pesticides into rivers and lakes. And on top of those benefits, farmers who have embraced cover crops are seeing improved soil quality and yields, too. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Airplanes from algae? It could happen. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Algae gets a bad rap for toxic blooms that pollute lakes, ponds, and waterways, but the microorganism could be cleaning up its image by way of two new promising innovations.
Scientists are using algae to develop an industrial-strength material that's as hard as steel, but only a fraction of the weight.
Yale Climate Connections reports that researchers at Munich's Technical University came up with a process that uses oil from algae to create carbon fibers, which can be used in cars, airplanes, and buildings.
Making the fiber uses far less energy than manufacturing concrete or steel, and the process emits less carbon pollution.
Another benefit? The microorganisms absorb CO2 as they grow, so when algae oil is used to make the fibers, the carbon gets sequestered inside.
Algae is also being used to filter contaminants out of water. Researchers at the Bartlett School of Architecture in London created ceramic tiles that, through a process called bioremediation, use algae to break down pollutants.
The tiles contain slots in the shape of a fan or leaf, and they're inlaid with microalgae and a seaweed-based hydrogel. Water travels through the tiles and comes out at the bottom clean and usable.
Fast Company reports that the water can be run through the system multiple times, depending on its level of contamination.
The overuse of antibiotics can lead to drug-resistant bacteria and superbugs. Now, a new study shows that the use of antibiotics in livestock can have negative effects on soils.
Scientists at Colorado State University and the University of Idaho compared soils that had manure from livestock treated with antibiotics to those that didn't.
They found that soil with manure from livestock treated with antibiotics retained much less carbon and released more CO2 into the atmosphere. They also observed that the manure containing antibiotics altered nitrogen cycling.
Manure is considered to be a helpful fertilizer that adds nutrients and carbon to the soil, but this benefit might be offset when antibiotics are given to livestock.
In the U.S., 80% of antibiotics produced are used in livestock production. And worldwide, their use is expected to increase by nearly 70% in the next 10 years.
They're calling them storm quakes. Researchers at Florida State University say hurricanes and other strong storms can produce seismic events in the ocean floor as powerful as a magnitude 3.5 earthquake.
Their study explains that hurricanes, or nor'easters, transfer energy into the ocean and create strong ocean waves that can shake the seafloor and can last from hours to days.
Not all storms can cause storm quakes. For instance, Hurricane Sandy didn't spur underground activity. But when storm quakes do occur, they're concentrated in the areas off the coast of Mexico or along the U.S. from New Jersey to Georgia.
Although the quakes are small and barely perceptible, the scientists say they could have effects on marine life and aquatic systems that have yet to be studied.
Freshwater mussels that live in rivers are critical to their ecosystems because they control silt and filter water.
But for some unknown reason, the mollusks are dying in diverse regions like Tennessee and Virginia in the east and Oregon and Washington in the west. They're also dying in Spain.
There are about 300 species of freshwater mussels in North America, and nearly 75% are listed as endangered, threatened, or of concern due to human degradation of rivers. In the southeast alone, nearly 24 species of mussels are thought to have gone extinct.
A team including the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is investigating what The Guardian describes as a bizarre decline of the bivalves, and researchers suspect that at least on the Clinch River in Tennessee, the die-off may be caused by disease because other animals are not similarly decreasing.
With the die-off of the mussels, one expert said, affected rivers will never look the same. They'll be cloudier and even smell different. And finally, Qatar, the small desert country that sits on a peninsula in the Persian Gulf, is one of the hottest places on Earth. Summer temperatures can soar to a sizzling 115 degrees Fahrenheit. So in order to make life bearable in the capital, Doha, they're adding air conditioning to the outdoors.
Giant coolers have been installed along sidewalks and in outdoor shopping malls so people can go about their daily lives. Over the past three decades, Qatar has seen average temperatures rise more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial times, exceeding the 1.5 degree goal set in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement.
And as temperatures rise, the effort to cool the city is making the situation worse. Carbon emissions drive warming, which in turn drive the need for air conditioning, which then requires burning more fossil fuels that emit carbon dioxide, a vicious cycle.
The Washington Post reports that Qatar is the world's largest per capita emitter of greenhouse gases, nearly three times as much as the U.S. and almost six times as much as China.
Experts say the high heat is exacerbated by urbanization and resulting heat islands, as well as warming waters in the Persian Gulf. Rising sea temperatures are generating more atmospheric humidity, which can result in heat stress. That's because a human body cools off when sweat evaporates, which slows or even stops with high humidity.
A senior scientist at the Qatar Environment and Energy Research Institute said that for rapidly growing urban areas throughout the Middle East, the combination of heat and humidity will one day make being outside in those areas intolerable, in which case outdoor air conditioning would no longer be a convenience, it would be essential to survival.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, whose North American Water Loss Conference will showcase innovative solutions December 3rd through 5th in Nashville. Get the details at awwa.org/waterloss.
Eco Radio is produced by a team of collaborators, including yours truly, Craig Lubo, Teresa Wilkie, Dave Bennett, and Brent Ragsdale. Thanks to Ryan Porky for our theme music. I'm Richard Mabian, reminding you to give your feedback by contacting us at ecoradio@gmail.com or reaching out to Eco Radio KC, our Facebook page.
to sync at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
During the beginning of the 20th century, yet another unique American music form developed. When Mexican-American musicians from Texas began to play the accordions brought by immigrants from Germany and Czechoslovakia, the result was Tejano, or Tex-Mex music.